this is a complicated system. I think it's going to take multiple years before they can perfect it. It's going to be a tough situation for NASA and for SpaceX. What they've gotten themselves into, I think they're going to have a hard time getting out of it. Anyway, back to you, Wesley. WSUN.
Okay, Anthony Sheehan. Talking about Artemis program, so they're trying to perfect that because it's going to be like side to side, not back to front of the tank, side to side, fuel exchange. So they're trying to perfect that before the lunar landing on Artemis 3, and the question is how the space launch system of Lockheed Martin and Orion spacecraft is related to that. I mean, Boeing is the space launch system, and the Lockheed Martin is Orion spacecraft, how they are related to that.
Yeah, well, Orion is primarily built by Lockheed. Boeing and Lockheed are involved with the Space Launch System. So now, you know, look at all the fights that you're going to need. You know, you need the Space Launch System to launch the Orion spacecraft to the moon. And that's all NASA. You know, they've successfully done that once. And the Orion spacecraft went around the moon, came back 2022, November. And that went on a 25-day flight. Now, imagine a crew in that thing. Okay, now the crew gets to the moon. And then now they don't have a lander to get down to the moon. They need to have either Blue Origin is developing one, or SpaceX. Right now they're contracted with SpaceX for the first two flights, Artemis 3 and Artemis 4. They didn't launch Artemis 2 yet. Artemis 2 is just a flight around the moon and back. 3 and 4. But 3 involves, you know, a crew orbiting the moon with no other space station or anything to dock to, just orbiting the moon. And here comes the Starship. They're going to have to dock with Orion, transfer the crew, and then the Starship goes down and lands on the moon, like I was saying before. But to do all that, you know, you need this refueling process. I know what they plan on doing. The fuel tank, the service station flying in orbit, will dock with the Starship coming up, and they're going to sit side by side. They need this mechanism to be connected, like these quick disconnect connections that when a rocket takes off. Imagine doing this in space, having these types of systems connect in orbit, belly to belly, on two different fuel systems, on liquid oxygen and liquid methane, and then transferring the fuel. That's not easy either. You know, if these things are in orbit, you know, you don't have gravity, so they might have to have they call them ullage thrusters. So when they're fueling these, you know, exterior thrusters might have to be fired to, yeah, temporarily creating gravity, you know, in one direction, you know, in both vehicles, so that the fuel transfer will go easier. I think they're in over their heads for, you know, that's my opinion. I hope the engineers have sat down with their calculators and figured this thing all out, but I think they're a long way from completing it. Supposedly they did it on two Starship flights ago.
K2NDR.
They launched Starship, and they transferred fuel from one tank to another tank was inside of the vehicle. And that doesn't involve, you know, quick disconnect connections. It doesn't involve anything, just a hard connection from one to the other, just transferring the fuel. And from my understanding, they did, I think, six tons of fuel was successfully transferred. And I don't think it was liquid oxygen. I forgot which. I don't know if it was. I think it was only the liquid methane that they did. Anyway, they have to do this with both. So, I don't know what else you want me to tell you. That's all. About all I know about it. They got a long way to go, I think.
There was somebody questioning.
Was it a K2NVO or something close to that?
Nobody else. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to need you just a few minutes from now for another one. Right now, to avoid a professional, the story how and when humans lost their tails. So I found online that it was 25 million years ago, so we had a tail like a dog or monkey, because we are animals. Dr. Roy, please.
Well, as an aside, I think Marcus House is kind of a shill for SpaceX, so I would personally take him with a grain of salt. And I sort of agree with Paul. I think SpaceX bit off a lot more than they could chew. They have no particular experience doing this, and this is a critical thing to do, transfer fuel. When you're going to have to refuel using a minimum of 6, possibly even 10, and you haven't done anything other than pump a fuel inside a stable rocket flying. It's a lot different transferring fuel inside a rocket. You don't have to coordinate two different things. They can travel at different velocities and do all kinds of things. So I think that NASA is going to have to burn a lot of money and start from not scratch, but a little bit earlier on and rethink their multi-fuel things. Anyway, it's not like I'm going to give you guys a whole explanation of evolution. We are monkeys. We are apes. We evolved from common ancestors. Our ancestors were not chimpanzees. They were not gorillas. They were not orangutans. But, again, if you go back in time, there's a common ancestor from which the different branches broke off, and we became Homo sapiens sapiens. And one of the many things is that early primates had tails, and obviously most of us don't. Some people, unfortunately, are kind of born with small prehensile tails. It's an evolutionary little kickback to the good old times. We all continue to have a coccyx, which is a tailbone, which is very useful for other things than hanging a tail on. I'm not exactly sure what the point of this discussion might be, but I'm sure most of you guys hopefully believe in evolution.
Okay, and then another question is, we have a certain muscle that some of them are functionless, and the muscles disappear just standard genetic at work. A mutation causes people to be born without them, and because the muscles aren't in use, you might not even notice that the vestigial muscles disappear with small populations. I wonder if this is some sort of some factor talking about the next stage of evolution, or it is just very much particular future for a certain group of people. But
you know what Wesley is talking about is a very inconsequential muscle. It's been known for hundreds of years. It screws up mammograms occasionally by obscuring the breasts from that angle. It's relatively rare. Anywhere from about 4 to 8% of the population have at least one of those muscles on one side. The probability of fetally developing that small muscle on both sides is about 1% of the population. So again, you don't really see a lot of it. It doesn't really have much of an effect. We don't really know what it once might have been, or whether it's just a kind of a genetic or developmental hiccup that sometimes happens due to something else. We know it's there. We know what percentage of it is there. We're not quite sure what it might have been once upon a time, we're not quite sure, but I would imagine it's kind of going to be going. But the problem is, it's not a problem, there's nothing particularly negative except screwing up the occasional mammogram. So there's no kind of evolutionary need to breed it out of the humanity, because it doesn't improve or undermine survivability.
A global surface temperature in the graph that I have in front of me from Wikipedia shows, you would say about time zero, this is the time when our calendar started. We have right now 2024. Let's say they put it at temperature zero. Then about in the year 1500, the temperature would, global temperature went down, and then all of a sudden in 1880, was it due to the Industrial Revolution? The average temperature went up drastically, almost vertically. So the climate change right now we're talking about, is it something that is a drastically dangerous and not reversible, or it's just because the Earth by itself around this time is going through the transfer that was going in the past? Back to you.
Okay, well, this is good old climate change. And Paul suggested that we kind of bring that up a little bit tonight, because New York City has put us on a drought watch, because I think this is kind of the second driest summer we've had in the history of New York. And the problem is that we seem to be breaking all kinds of bad records. You know, one in a century storms are happening every other. Am I back?
That's
Testing 1, 2, 3.
You're back now.
Yeah, I'm trying to fix it.
I'm back.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't work. Wesley, if you talk and I talk, I never know if I'm back. But I'm sorry, I fell out of all stock. So, I mean, the point that I think Paul wanted to discuss is, you know, why are all these things happening? Is it just happenstance? It just so happens that the temperature of the oceans have been going up every year for the last 100 years. Is it just happenstance that the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere is going up every year? Is it just happenstance that we're burning carbon dioxide, burning stuff and throwing tons of carbon dioxide in the air every hour? The Earth has a certain ability to equilibrate, but you know, even the Earth, if we put our mind to it, we can screw it up. So I don't think this is happenstance, because even if it is, say there's a 50-50 chance of happenstance, well, if the 50% that is not happenstance is us screwing the Earth up, and we stop screwing the Earth up, then we survive. As opposed to us just kind of saying, if 50%, it's just going to happen no matter what. Just sit down there and pray to God. He'll take care of it for us. You know, there's the old phrase that God takes care. The bottom line is you take care of your stuff. You know, God will let you take care of it. So I mean, I think that we're in trouble. Some people understand it, want to do something about it. Other people are just short-sighted and greedy and just want to burn, baby, burn. And, you know, other people just don't have the faintest clue.
Right now we have about 8.2 billion people. 10 years ago we had 7.02 billion people. So we had a discussion with Dr. Roy, who was... looking at the population data graphs, and I was kind of in confusion or disagreement, because I thought that every 10 years we have another billion people more in the Earth, and for the past for years, humanity was able to destroy 60% of creatures that are on planet Earth, including greens. What's going to be next year, in 10 years? What's going to be next 20 years? That's all right.
Well, since I don't have a crystal ball, I don't know. By the way, the phrase was, God helps those who help themselves. Anyway, we had this discussion. You got guys like Elon Musk who thinks that we're losing population, so that's probably why he wants to have 150 children or something. I don't know. It depends upon the area. Japan is losing population. Their demographics are shifting to somewhat more elderly people, which is not good for the economy, because elderly people need to be taken care of, not take care of others. So you have Japan having a population problem. China is having enormous population problems. They used to have a one-child policy, and they forced women to abort their fetuses and such. And then they turned around and started to offer to give them, you know, $5 if they have a kid. And the Chinese people are very frightened of the economy, and they don't want to invest in children. So the population of China is growing old and diminishing. So, you know, India is getting bigger. The United States, I think the endemic population isn't growing that fast. I think most of it is from immigration. So it's not a simple equation. I mean, can humanity overpopulate and lead to starvation? Possibly. But Malthus said that we were going to do it 300 years ago. Again, things are complicated, and agriculture is very complicated. And, you know, Malthus didn't have a clue about the second green revolution that increased the amount of food supply to the world exponentially. So I don't know what the future brings. I know that we're not rational creatures, human beings. We're quite irrational, and we do stuff for all kinds of silly reasons. So whether one of those silly reasons is going to kill us all, I don't know.
Anyhow, it's good. There is a famous, very pretty person, Cleogra. And she has 4.33 million subscribers on YouTube. And she put a video showing robots killing weeds with lasers. Apart from that, the tractor that is the machinery that is on the farm, on the field, is operating automatically with GPS, able to recognize billions of the wheat and other plants that not supposed to be on that field, and able to put into the soil with the same machine millions of seeds in the right place of it. So that's what humanity does right now with the high technology to feed us. But that was just to mention by me, because there's not much to talk about unless Dr. Roy has a comment. I don't believe that he had a chance to watch this video.
Well, you know, it was a cute video of laser beams. I mean, how could you go wrong with laser beams? So, look, there's all kinds of different ways of handling agriculture. Many of the high technology, it will improve the productivity, but a lot of third world countries don't have the infrastructure to afford the expensive industrial equipment, and more of the genetic engineering is important to them than tractors or robots or laser beams. But, you know, it's possible to increase the productivity of agriculture, and so that the world can kind of sustain a bigger population. Generally speaking, in our lifetimes, most starvations were not so much due to inability to produce food, but to distribute the food, either mechanically or by war or some kind of power play where supply lines were stopped and locked up. So, but, you know, I mean, if we breed enough human beings, eventually we can come to a point of no return where you just can't feed them all. But, again, that's the future. I can't predict it.
Yes. So, in the short words, you have a machinery that is going on the field by itself and could be switched on and switched off using your smartphone that you have with the app, and is putting the seeds inside, is killing all of the weeds using laser. So the video shows like the laser is pinpoint accuracy burning the weeds that are there. Unbelievable. The next subject, because we don't want to take too much time, is the nuclear reactor that is a mobile, is small, and it is right now, with the help of Department or U.S. Department of Energy, being built, but it's a company in Segundo, California, that is doing that, and the name of company is Radiant Industries, I Incorporated. They are 18 months, I put in email 12 months, but it's 18 months from the prototype to be finished, and they expect 50 nuclear reactors that are portable reactors that could be produced yearly. And not far from that reactor, you could have a McDonald's, you can have any kind of school, and it's not harmful to that. Dr. Roy, if you have any comment.
Well, you know, it will be interesting to see you explain it to the average person why they shouldn't be afraid. They were afraid of nuclear magnetic resonance imagers, so that they had to be renamed magnetic resonance imagers because it had the word nuclear. So no matter what you tell people, if it's a nuclear reactor, they're going to be upset. So I leave it to you. There are so many startup companies that report so many innovative designs and projects that are just waiting to be developed, and then they go bankrupt and you you never hear from them again. And when you start to read about places like Microsoft and Google that are setting up small size mini nuclear generators, it's inevitably manufactured by the same old-time guys that build all this heavy stuff. The innovators occasionally break through. 1 out of 100, 2 out of 100, but not 99 out of 100. So I wish them luck, but I wouldn't put a penny on their stock option at this point. You never know.
The Kaleidos is the name of the reactor. It is 3.5, 3.5 megawatts, generator. Nuclear generator, high temperature, gas cooled micro reactor. I'm reading right now, cooled with helium. Now, what is good about helium, I have in my lab, I have a small chamber that is cooled to 4 degrees of Kelvin, actually 2 degrees of Kelvin, but 4 is listed on it. And what they do is, instead of using water or any kind of cooling medium, they use helium for it. And the helium is heated, liquid helium, and the helium is heated to 400 degrees of, I'm not sure Celsius or Fahrenheit. And that heat is then provided to the turbine that is producing electricity for it. And it's extremely small one. So the generator by itself is approximately 2 feet by 2 feet cylinder, but it requires a quite big dome made from special concrete. And efficient zirconium hydride moderator. So that would be it. We'll see what's going to happen. But everything can blow, even small reactor too. Do you agree with that, Dr. Ray?
Yes, and unfortunately you have to put this in its place. The population is frightened of cell towers. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. There's still people complaining to take the fluorine out of the water. So anything that's called nuclear, you got a problem. And ultimately, even if they don't label it nuclear, someone's going to mention nuclear fuel, and it's basically a fission generator. So you're going to have a lot of PR problems, this company, if they ever see light of day, which is also questionable. But, you know, I wish them the best.
Me too. The next subject, and after that, we're going to pull permanently for the rest of the night. But it is actually a need for Paul to comment on it. There was a video that I sent to Paul and to you, Dr. Roy. The title is "Those Images Will Change Your View on Comets Forever." And they blew our minds. It is shown a number of comets, pretty much known before the technically, there was a person who said that he is in astronomy group, so he would be probably interested as well. So we have, as a first point, we have the history of Japanese mission on Comet Halley. And that was in the 90s. I wonder if Paul had the chance to look at it. To the Paul, please.
Yeah, I saw the email, the very beginning of the video, and then I realized it was 127 minutes long, I think, and I wasn't about to sit through that. By the time I looked at it anyway, it was probably about an hour or so before the net, so I wasn't going to watch that. Yeah. If it's talking about the Japanese spacecraft that went to visit the Halley Comet, yeah, they're the only ones that got close to it or got any kind of information out of it when it last came by here. Or is it, I think it comes around every 70 years or so. So we had plans about 3 or 4 different spacecraft were supposed to go out and visit that thing. But due to launch failures and problems with scheduling flights and all that, they were all canceled. So I'm not sure what Japan got out of it. Back to you, West, WS2M.
From the video, they told that it was sent very close to Halley. It was able to observe the Halley and the tail, and it was very cold. And the tail was very cold as well. And the reason that we see Halley periodically after 70-something years is because the sun is reflecting from the tail particles and from the comet, and it's nucleus. I'm not sure if I use the proper word, nucleus. I mean, it's the center of it. They had a mission where the particle, one of the particles, destroyed the camera. The first rocket that was successful didn't have a camera, but was able to find a lot about it. The second one had a camera, but one of the particles hit the camera on it, and the spacecraft couldn't stabilize. It lost the contact for 30 minutes, and then after that they were able to establish communication with the spacecraft, but the camera wasn't working. The next one in that is the crash, and that's kind of troubling to all of you listening to that. Let me drop it. The crash Comet Shoemaker into Saturn in July 1994, hitting Jupiter's atmosphere to 30,000 degrees of Celsius, and is in the same video. So energy released in the collision at speed of 216,000 kilometers per hour. Imagine how fast it is. Was the equivalent of 300 million nuclear bombs, and the diameter of the largest fragment of the Shoemaker comet that was colliding with Jupiter was 2 kilometers. Now, it raises a concern about the collision of the Earth at the end of the Cretaceous period that was 66 million years ago, when asteroid hit the Earth, and that asteroid was the size of the city. So it was much bigger than 2 kilometers. Do you have a comment on it, Paul?
Yeah, with the Shoemaker-Levy comet. Yeah, I remember that in the 90s. That made big news. What happened was the only spacecraft at the time that was going to be able to take a picture of when a comet hit was Voyager, because that was going to be beyond, beyond our orbit, beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And when it was going to hit, it was going to hit on the opposite side of Jupiter. Jupiter spins, a little over nine hours. It rotates. And where the comet was going to hit, was going to be out of view of the telescopes here on Earth, including Hubble. So they wouldn't be able to see it. see they'd be able to see it as the planet rotated. So sure enough, the first piece hit, and then the planet rotated. You could see the dark shadow, and they showed all this the results live on TV when we watched it. One lady in charge, Heidi. Her name was Heidi. She was terrific. She gave the updates as it was hitting. They were all the scientists were sitting in front of the screens, and we were looking at the scientists look at the screens, and they were giving us updates as they would hit. And as each one hit, see what happened is Shoemaker-Levy comet, as it got near Jupiter, broke apart due to gravitational forces. The front part of the comet was closer to Jupiter, so that actually pulled away. And then the next piece, and they wound up with this long string, of like 20 pieces. So they knew they were going to hit one at a time as it hit Jupiter. Let me drop it. So as far as the relationship to ham radio goes, they, ARRL, said, anybody with 10-meter capability pointed to Jupiter. Because Jupiter gives off natural radiation, or a signal from the planet. It's a constant noise that can be picked up. So pointed to Jupiter, and you'll notice a difference in that noise. And you can, if you had a beam and you pointed it to Jupiter, you normally hear it a little louder, and then you point away, and the signal is a little lower. Which I was at the time, I had a homebrewed 10-element, a 2-element beam for 10 meters. I was able to do that, and they said you would notice as the pieces hit, each one after the other, a slight difference in the noise from that you're getting from Jupiter. So I had a recorder, and I set it up, and sure enough, it was a slight difference, but the recorder barely picked up the noise to make it worth sending it in. But I could hear the difference. So every now and then, another piece would hit of the comet. And they call it a string of pearls. So one at a time would hit, and we always hit on the opposite side from what we could see. And Voyager actually picked up some of the impact, which they downloaded later. Interesting time when that happened, and that made big news. Were you in the country at the time? Because that was all over the news. Back to you.
Yes, I was, and I remember that time. But talking about that, I think about Cretaceous Paleogene Dials, or known also as the KPG Mars Extinction event that occurred in the Earth when the meteor slammed into the Earth at the end of Cretaceous period. And the impact and its artifact killed roughly 75% of animal plant species on the planet, including a whole group like 9 avian dinosaurs and ammonites. So are we prepared? Yes, we can know, at least I think we can know, that we will be able to see much before something hits the Earth and ends our existence on the planet. But I have a question to both of you, Dr. Roy and Paul. Are we ready? Do we have something? I mean, I'm not sure how the nuclear warhead can blow in the space. It can. But are we ready with the technology to make us survive if it happens. Maybe first I would like to ask to write for the comments.
AC2GS. Well, I believe, and Paul will correct me if I'm wrong, we tried that. We shot a rocket at something up there to see if it deflects anything. It has to be powerful enough, and it has to be early enough. You know, the farther away you deflect it, the more effective it is. So it's early, very early detection and very high power energy collisions that might be able to do it. Right now, I don't know if we're up for it. Every so often we get spooked by a meteor that we didn't even see coming.
I know what you're talking about. Paul could say more about it. There was the small spacecraft that was sent to collide with the asteroid, and then the deflection was measured from the course of the comet. Paul, please.
The Hunt mission, that went up a couple of years ago, and, you know, you had... Once the spacecraft got near that, it was a binary system. There were two asteroids going around one another, you know, a large one and a smaller one. So the spacecraft would separate, and they had this one heavy piece. I think it was primarily a lot of weight of copper, 800 pounds, I think, slammed into the smaller asteroid, like miles per hour, whatever the speed was, and it did affect the time the smaller asteroid would re-orbit the larger one by, like, I don't know, 30 seconds or something. It floated down. So now by doing that, it changes the orbit of it to the point where the total mass of the large one is affected by the, you know, by the, not only the Earth but the Sun, you know. It does change it, you know, a slight degree from where it was. So now both of them, the degree changes. You know, it did work. So if you see these things early enough, a binary system like that, you could theoretically do that and push it in the proper direction. And you got to make sure you know what you're doing. You don't want to push it into the wrong direction where it's going to hit the Earth. It did work. That only helps for binaries. But what happens when a big old asteroid is coming by? The theory of lighting a nuke off and thinking you're going to change it, that doesn't work. Because most of these things are like big piles of rubble. They're kind of loosely packed together. That's what happened to Shoemaker-Levy. It just separated when the tidal forces got involved when it got near Jupiter. So if you nuke one of these things, instead of having one big asteroid hit the Earth, now you might hit, you know, you might have 10 big ones hitting the Earth, you know. So, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But, you know, I mean, they're working on it. But, you know, these things happen so infrequently, the odds of really anything happening probably, you know, in our lifetime is probably near zero. What's interesting about that big one that hit, that killed both the dinosaurs, it was about 6 miles in diameter. Let me drop it. Could you imagine something that big? First of all, you're not going to break it apart with, I don't care how many nukes. But as this thing came into the Earth's atmosphere, it's coming at it, I think they said around 40 to 50,000 miles per hour. That means when the first part was actually hitting the Earth, it was over by the Yucatan Peninsula. But when that part was hitting the Earth, coming in at that speed. The top part of it is 6 miles off of where airplanes fly. You know, I mean, if you could stop it for that millisecond, you know, as it was hitting the Earth, that's how big this thing was. You know. So I don't think you're going to break it apart with a nuke or not. Yeah, I mean, I think we're better off just, you know, making a sign of the cross and hope for the best. Back to you, Wes. Good topic. WS1.
Yeah, I wonder what is better for us to not know that something is going to hit the Earth and we're going to lose life. Our children is going to die. And everything around us is going to die. We're just in some time before it's going to happen. For us to prepare if it's going to happen. Hopefully that doesn't happen that often. Temple 1. Is a periodic Jupiter family comet discovered by Wilhelm Temple in 1867. It completes an orbit of the Sun 5 to 6 years, and Temple 1 was the target of Deep Impact space mission, which photographed a deliberate high-speed impact upon the comet in 2005. It was revisited by Stratus spacecraft on February 14, 2011 and came back in August 2016. And on May 26, it will make a modest approach on 0.55 AU Jupiter. So it's the little bit outdated information because it did happen. If you have a few words about it, the rest of the sentences which will lift the perihelion distance at 9P will next come, okay, whatever. Anyhow, May 26 of the Temple 1. Back to you.
Yeah, that impact, that the goal was not to try to see if they could move it or use it, you know, use the spacecraft to deflect anything. The goal of that was to impact it just to see what it was made of, you know, that type of thing. That was more of a science investigation than a physics experiment on making a move. But did that video show the Stardust mission, the one that went to Vilt 2? Vilt is spelled like the word wild, the B-Y-L-T. Did it go to, but it's pronounced Vilt. Did it show anything about the Stardust mission? That was a good mission. That was successful. That's the one that went out, and that was a comet, and they wanted to pick up the particles of the comet. And it had this like the size of a tennis racket, with something called aerogel attached to it, and it was able to, you know, pick up little particles. And then after it did, it folded back into the descent vehicle. And then as Stardust eventually came past the Earth, the descent vehicle separated from the mothership and descended into the atmosphere and landed in Utah, proving range out in Utah. You know, the Army has that range out there.
there's like nobody out there for, you know, hundreds of miles. And that's where they picked up the canister, you know, the descent module. And that was successful. They were able to figure out what particles the that built comet had. That was a great mission. Stardust, very successful. But, anyway, back to you. SWS doing that. I'm not sure if you want to know anything more about Temple One, except apparently you're saying it's coming back. Back to you.
Yeah, it was shown the Stratus spacecraft action and pictures and taken from that. So yeah, if you have a time to look at it, it's really nicely done video. I have only two subjects here, and then I'm done. One is about comet IKEA that broke into three pieces just before the passage. What caught my attention is that those fragments frequently orbit in our solar system, and the small particles, small things, they are out of that. They do the same. So in other words, yes, we know the trajectory, we know where they are, at least we can somehow calculate where those pieces are, but that's a kind of hazard to the spacecraft here. We've not been talking about the chunk that human animals put here in space. But the question is, how much of the natural small orbiting passaging fragments of the comet frequently orbit our solar system, if you have an idea, and maybe a few words about the comet IKEA. Thank you.
The IKEA one, that was supposed to be a big one that we were going to be able to see early in the morning. Went around the sun, and then if it was held together, we would be able to see it with the tail and all. From what I understand, it did break up, and the only thing people could see was remnants of the tail. And it was early in the morning, but if it held together, it was going to be a -8 on the magnitude scale, which would have been bright, would have been like twice as bright as say Venus. Venus is the brightest object in the star in the sky. So that would have been good. And that was supposed to be October 23rd, but that didn't go well. The gravity of the sun pulled it apart again. It's the effect that gravity has. If something comes close to it, the front part of it gets pulled more than the back part of it, and so that front part pulls, you know, is under more of a gravitational strain. And it, in a black hole, that would be spaghettification, they call it. But it, you know, here it just gets pulled apart. Same idea though, due to the tidal forces, that thing disappeared. Otherwise, I'll have to view the rest of that video. You know, could always talk about it next week or the week after. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, the last one, Rosetta. Rosetta was the space probe built by the European Space Agency, launched on March 2nd, 2004. And it had a lander module called Philly. Rosetta performed detailed study on comet Churyumov Gerasimenko. I mean, I'm reading it properly the way that it's supposed to be pronounced, but you're gonna have a problem with proper pronunciation on it. During the comment, the spacecraft performed flybys Earth, Mars, and asteroids 21 Luteria. On August 6, 2014, the spacecraft reached the comet and performed a series of maneuvers. If you happen to know something about it, that was, or Rosetta was also the first mission ever to orbit comet's nucleus and land a probe on its surface. Back to you.
Yeah, Rosetta was a European Space Agency mission launched from Kourou, South America. I think it took around almost 14 years to get there, something like that. I remember when it launched, and then saying to myself, boy, I'm going to be really old when that happens. That's already many years ago. And it got out to the comet. You're better off just calling it 67. You know,
that time number, complete.
It's named after two people that discovered the comet, and each one has a longer name than the other one. Went out to comet 67, and then did wind up eventually orbiting that. A comet, and like I said, it was the first spacecraft to ever do that. And then they had the lander, the Philippe. Philippe separated from the mothership, and it went down to the surface, and it just touched the surface, but then they lost the signal, and apparently got stuck in between, like a little cave almost, like a piece of the comet that was like sticking out, like cantilevered over the lander itself. So they had very short contact with land. I mean, we're talking about 30 seconds or so. And then did have batteries on board, so they kept trying to pick up the signal from it. And then as the spacecraft eventually went around the sun, you know, because they lost the signal, and then came around the other side, they were hoping to pick up the signal that the batteries would get recharged from a different angle of the sun. But, you know, I don't think that worked out. But they tried. But it's very successful because the mothership itself got tremendous pictures, close-up pictures, and spectroscopic, you know, off the comet. And so you know what it's made of. So yeah, very good mission, very exciting. And you know, European Space Agency does a lot of great missions. The outer solar system. This thing was way out there when they did that. I think it was way past Mars at the time when it landed. Back to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for all the information, for the time given to me, and thank you to the audience for listening. Dr. Roy, please speak up.
Looks like we ran out of time.
I'm looking
at the clock here.
Yeah, time runs fast. AC2GS, I don't know how you want to handle it. You know, the repeater's open for another hour if you're so inclined. It's probably the worst day to do this because, you know, biologically it's midnight to most of our brains. But take it away, Paul.
I concur. I'll just do the bold-faced titles, I guess. That's the best thing. Because this Friday, I plan on, from home, I'm going to watch or listen to. I think it's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be a teleconference or not, but anyway, NASA's going to have a news conference with the three of the four astronauts that